Hey guys, Bill here. Before we get started today, just wanted to mention that the show is sponsored today by our pals at SeatGeek. And you know, if you're someone who listens to the podcast, I am a SeatGeek user, I am a SeatGeek supporter, and they too are a supporter of the Bill Barnwell Show. And if you want to get tickets to anything, whether it's the Super Bowl, whether it is minor league baseball coming in a few months to your local area, I don't know what you want to buy tickets to. But if it's a sporting event, a concert, boxing or MMA, theater, whatever you want to get tickets to, trust me, go to SeatGeek first because they're going to get you a good deal. They're going all around the web to look at tickets that are going to fit your needs, whether it's something that's very close to the stage or close to the field, something far away, just want to get in the building. No matter what you're looking for, SeatGeek is going to have it, and you're going to get a purchase that is fully guaranteed so you can shop with confidence. You're not going to get fake tickets using SeatGeek. So I use SeatGeek app on my phone all the time. Whenever I want to go somewhere and I want to see if I want to go to an athletic event or a concert or theater, I'm not going to lie, it's mostly sporting events. I'm not really cultured. But if you're cultured, I would say go on your phone and download the SeatGeek app and then use promo code Barnwell. You'll get $10 off your first SeatGeek purchase by going to checkout, entering in promo code Barnwell, B-A-R-N-W-E-L-L, $10 off your first SeatGeek purchase today. SeatGeek. Life's an event. We have the tickets. Now here's the show. Welcome to the Bill Barnwell Show. I'm Bill Barnwell, ESPN. We are here on Monday. It's January 21st, 2019. The conference championship games have finished. Two really exciting, really compelling games. Endings maybe not the most exciting for the team, the two losing teams involved, but certainly games who were very fascinating, to me as a neutral. And we have a Super Bowl matchup. It is going to be the New England Patriots and the Los Angeles Rams in Atlanta in 2 weeks. Joining us to talk about these conference championship games, though, frequent contributor to the show, someone who was in the press box for the Patriots Chiefs game. A lot to talk about with that. It's going to be ESPN's Mike Sando. Mike, how are you?
I'm doing well, yes. I was seated next to the esteemed Liz Merrill in the press box. She has some roots from that area, so we were able to watch the Chiefs.
Very exciting game. Obviously, I'm hoping you were indoors in the press box.
I was. I definitely was indoors. It was chilly outside. It's amazing, the players, you know, even the cheerleaders were out there. I mean, it was, man, it was cold if you were out there for more than 20 minutes, but I wasn't. I was inside and I was nice and warm.
That's comforting. You might be able to hear now, we have the whatever chill was in Kansas City appears to have made it to New York, as you can hear the wind whipping through the side streets here, which is not ideal, but I'm safely ensconced indoors to talk about these games, and I think there's a lot to get to when it comes to Patriots, Chiefs. You know, so many different places to start. I'll just start with this, Mike. How do the Patriots do it? I mean, they pulled it off somehow again, and we're sitting here saying the same thing we said last year when the Jaguars were winning late in that game, and years before when the Ravens were beating the Patriots in the second half a couple of years back. They do this, and they always do it, and it seems simple in one way and seems incredibly complicated in another way. How do they pull this one off?
You know, something really stood out to me just watching the game, and you know, a lot of players on the Patriots come and go year to year, but think how many reps that Tom Brady and Julian Edelman and Rob Gronkowski, you know, the key guys who are making those plays with the game on the line, they have so many reps together. That's such a luxury in the NFL. You just don't keep guys together that long. The other thing, I did a study a few years ago, you know, it can be a burden, but the Patriots, because of how deep they play in the playoffs every year, have hundreds of additional practices compared to the other teams. If you just count up the number of practice sessions, so you have some core key contributors who, besides going to Montana to throw balls around like Brady and Edelman do, have just a ton of game and practice reps, and of course they're just very good. But I think you have that continuity. Brady touched on it yesterday. That's just huge. Coaching staff, quarterback, some of the key players. They're just better than you are. You know, not you personally, Bill, but I mean, they are better than you are if they're playing you.
Yeah, and I mean, you saw that when Brady needed to convert on a key first down in this game, when he converted those third and tens late in the contest, it was either going to be to Edelman, where they had a, you know, him really beating up people in the slot. They would sack the receivers and get a clean release for Edelman, and it was just done from there. He was going to get open. Or it was to Gronkowski, where the two big completions downfield late in the fourth quarter, and then in overtime, even though Eric Berry was on the field, they still went to Gronk on isolation routes, and he got there. He got open when he needed to get open, and he made a big play when he needed to make a big play. And I mean, you know, those guys aren't at their best. Julian Edelman, of course, is someone who in his 30s now. Rob Gronkowski, of course, we know he's not the athlete he used to be, but those guys just managed to make plays. It shouldn't be that simple, but in a way it is that simple.
It is. It's amazing. I am not a Patriot hater. You know, I just appreciate the level of excellence that they've achieved. And thinking that Tom Brady went against Kurt Warner in a Super Bowl and was going to go against Jared Goff in a Super Bowl, and it's just unbelievable to think that he could do it. And he was a driving force in the win. I mean, I know they haven't been as on fire offensively this year, but those third and tens, like you said, I think they also do such a great job of, you know, we can quibble with a plan here or there, but they have a plan that makes sense to them for the opponent they're playing. And they exploited the weaknesses of the Chiefs, and it was still a game that easily could have gone the other way. It doesn't guarantee they're going to win, but certainly put them in position to win. And remember, this game could have gotten away from the Chiefs early if Brady doesn't throw a really unusual interception in the first half of the game. So they executed their plan imperfectly. Had it been perfectly, I mean, they might have won by 10 points.
Right. And I think, you know, realistically, the Chiefs should be commended for you know, making this a game, given that they should have been down 14-0 early, if not for that interception. You know, the Patriots were moving the ball pretty consistently throughout this game. There was no pass rush on Brady from the defense, and the Chiefs were shut out at halftime and managed to score 30 points, right? In the second half, which is remarkable. I mean, that's staggering to think how they were able to pull that off and sort of drag themselves back into this football game. And even though the Patriots, I think, were on a play-to-play basis the more consistent team, the Chiefs made so many big plays on both sides of the football that they were able to, you know, honestly make this a game where it came down to a play here or there, as opposed to being, you know, a game where the Patriots dominated from start to finish.
The Chiefs are so explosive, and because Mahomes is so young, this didn't feel like another Kansas City playoff meltdown where it's right. Just, oh, you want to bang your head on the wall. I'm sure some Chiefs fans wanted to, but there's so much hope. I mean, they're just getting started with Mahomes. Look, after the game, I was in this little cramped interview room, and I actually had the gall to ask Belichick if he considered running more time off the clock after they were under a minute with first and goal from the four. Mm-hmm. With Mahomes, you have to actually determine whether you're going to run it in or not. I mean, it's like, do you want to leave him 36 seconds or 19 seconds? You know what I mean? I mean, it was that's how quickly, when you just need a field goal, that's how quickly Mahomes can move it down the field. I mean, I felt more nervous for New England than Kansas City after they scored. I felt like they're going to get a shot. They're going to move it in there. You can't hold him down. And Belichick's answer was, yeah, if we had done that and it didn't work, you'd be asking me a different line of questions. And then, you know, he said, too, hey, they had struggled in some short yardage. That was one thing that hadn't gone their way. So I thought that was a good answer. But that's just how good the Chiefs are offensively. That's why they went with this. I believe it was the fourth, by the way I measure this, the fourth heaviest run-oriented game plan in 306 starts by Brady.
Wow. I mean, it was effective. I mean, they were I think I have the number in my column today. Before the fourth and one stuff on Burkhead, they had picked up at least a yard on 32 of 35 carries.
Wow.
I mean, they were just consistently moving the ball.
Yeah, it's hard to do. That's one of the things I tweeted after the game was, hey, they tip your hat, because it's a hard way to win the game, getting to third down all the time and a bunch of third and tenths on the road in Arrowhead, converting them. And it says something about the Chiefs' defense, but it also was the plan, and it did work barely.
Yeah, I mean, barely is the way to put it. The Patriots, of course, won the coin toss in overtime and then did not cede the ball. They went and drove downfield for the game-winning touchdown, converting three third and tens along the way. Pass to Gronk got them in the red zone. Three Rex Burkhead runs, the final one, a touchdown to end the game without Patrick Mahomes touching the ball in overtime. Have you had feelings about the overtime rules before this point? And did what you saw yesterday change how you feel about the league's current overtime rules?
I like the way they changed it, whatever, 2012, to where you got to get a knockout punch. You got to get a touchdown. I feel like, especially the way we see people moving into range for field goal range, that before, the way it was before, was too much in favor of the team that won the coin toss. I don't think the numbers now suggest that it's a huge problem. I understand, you know, people, if people want to say, hey, just have a regular timed period that where you see what happens, I wouldn't go kicking and screaming, but I think then other dynamics of how you play the game change. I liked how it was yesterday, knowing, hey, they basically know they've got to get a touchdown because Mahomes is probably going to get one.
Right.
So it just made it, you know, it's not like the Chiefs didn't have their chances throughout the game. I don't feel like they were totally robbed. I liked it. I'm okay with it. I tweeted out some numbers that showed, you know, just winning that coin toss in overtime hasn't been a, you know, just an absolute huge killer. The percentages for when it happens when you win on the road, when you're on the road, are about the same as just winning on the road anyway. So I don't have a big problem. How about you?
I don't think I have a big problem with it. I wouldn't be horrified if they changed it for the postseason. I think the regular season rules are just fine the way they are. To me, I if they said, okay, we're going to give you 15, I put it in my column today, we're going to give you a 15-minute quarter, and either it'll be the final score at the end of that quarter, or if one team can get to 9 points. So if they can basically, you know, score twice with a 9-point lead, then the game will be over. I think that would... You would guarantee each team at least one possession. It would be in the context of normal football. It wouldn't be a shortened field like the college football overtime. But I'm not horrified by this. You know, I don't think it's unfair to the Chiefs that the overtime rules are like this. They needed to get a stop, and they couldn't stop Brady 3 times on 3rd and 10. That's just as viably part of the game as it is Patrick Mahomes, you know, taking the ball over on offense. So I wouldn't mind a longer overtime in the postseason, but I don't think it's unfair inherently based on what the rules are at the moment.
Yep. I also liked it. It was a good hear from Ben Baldwin, just saying, you know, the problem with guaranteeing each team a possession is that the second team has a huge advantage by already knowing what the first team did. So those are sort of those dynamics, you know, when you think about making something fair, it changes the other way the game's played. I mean, your suggestion's fine, and some of the other ones are okay. I just don't feel like it's broken. I don't feel like it was I think you fix things that are broken. I understand if you want to, you know, incrementally make it a little better, but I loved the game yesterday. That was championship weekend. That was the least of the worries.
Yeah, it seemed like the biggest concern was the refereeing in both games. We'll get to the Rams-Saints refereeing issues in a second. But, of course, in this game, a few different calls that were questionable or calls that maybe were missed. I think certainly the decision to call roughing the passer on Chris Jones when he hit Tom Brady in what appeared to be the shoulder pad. Pretty brutal call when it came to that. But I thought the Chiefs got a fair amount of the calls in this game. Even though, of course, you think about the, like I said, the Jones hit. You think about the Julian Edelman fumble that was overturned. The Chris Hogan catch that maybe could have been ruled an incompletion. I thought it was a catch to me, but I think a bunch of calls went their way, including most notably that pick play that should have been called for offensive pass interference on the pass that sprung Sammy Watkins into the 2-yard line.
I want consistent application of it. So it felt like to me this year in replay, they stopped re-officiating the play. They kind of went to the standard of, hey, it just has to be obvious. That happened a lot where you could see on there, hey, you know what? We could change that, but to me, when you start doing that, then you can have two errors on the play. You know, that's not what we're talking about. I want to catch the terrible play. Mm-hmm. So the problem I have is on the Edelman one, two problems. Number one, they ruled that he touched it. They don't know if he touched it. It just sort of looked like he did.
Right.
So, but then to go and change it when there was not clear and obvious, I mean, I think you could kind of make a case either way. They re-officiated it. Mm-hmm. To me, that was a re-officiation, I guess. I mean, that's something that I don't want to have happen if you're going to, you know, have a clear standard all the way through. So that was one, obviously, you know, does there need to be some kind of a panic button that somebody, another official in the stadium can press to say, wait a minute, guys, throw a flag and on the play that happened in the Saints game, that terrible could have called multiple fouls on the interference. Mostly you just hope that three, four people looking at that, somebody can throw the flag. You know, for Bill Vinovich to say he wasn't looking, well, we were watching the video. What else is he looking at, you know?
Right.
Terrible to miss it. That's just a breakdown in basic call. The other stuff, like roughing the passer, that you get what you, that's what you asked for when you want these rules to protect the quarterback. I understand those, even though they're, it's not a great call. This one is just like basic. Were you at the game? Anybody can see it. The fan videos were awesome. Like, people in the fans are like, they can't believe it.
Of course.
Genuine reactions of what just happened.
Do you think referees should have the ability to say, we don't know what the call is and we should go to video in the case of, you know, the Edelman fumble, for example, so you don't have that sort of, you know, prejudice of the initial call being the thing that has to be overturned on the field?
No. I mean, I think that's just another layer of, then we're discussing whether every play should have been looked at. I think that I like the idea of catch the egregious thing, otherwise play the game and live with some imperfections of officiating. It's just, that's just part of the game. Sometimes some of the breaks go with you, some go against you. We just don't want to have that play, the Saint play, where it's a blatant call. And I understand it's judgment, and they don't want to look at judgment calls, but there's no judgment involved in that. That's so blatant that there needs to be a remedy. And does that mean that every PI should be reviewed? I don't know about that. But why, in that situation, that play somehow needs to be, it has to be, you know, a standard of blatancy or something that lets you just fix an obvious wrong.
Yeah. I mean, clearly that was not the optimal outcome. I don't think anyone felt great about that call changing the game. And I think we'll get to it. And there's obviously more to the end of that game than just that one play. But, I mean, I it's hard to imagine that even the most hardcore Rams fan could sit there with a straight face and say that was not a penalty. I mean, Nickel Robey Coleman after the game said, yeah, I committed. Like, he didn't even pretend that he did not commit PI. He said, yeah, I was beat, and I just hit him. And, you know, I don't fault him for doing it. I think it was probably the right decision, given that, you know, probably would have been a touchdown if he didn't do it. But under any circumstance, it's just a wild play. In terms of this Chiefs-Patriots game, in terms of the Patriots game plan on defense, I sort of figured before the game, okay, well, they're going to be able to stop one guy. The Patriots, of course, we know it's their thing on defense, take away the other team's biggest weapon. In the past, it's been Travis Kelce. They've shut down, or not shut down, but slowed down Travis Kelce, and Tyreek Hill and Kareem Hunt ran wild on them the last two times they played, week one of 2017, week six of 2018. Somehow in this game, by changing their defensive personnel, by going with different rules and different sort of, a different sort of coverage structure with the cornerbacks they have on their roster, they managed to slow down Tyreek Hill and Travis Kelce. Kelce had a touchdown, but a pretty low yardage total. Tyreek Hill had one long catch, but that was it for him in the game. It was really mostly Damian Williams and secondary receivers otherwise catching the football for the Chiefs. So how did Bill Belichick do this? How was he able to stop both Hill and Kelce for the vast majority of this game?
Yeah, well, you know, when they played, when the Chiefs played Seattle, I thought Seattle did a good job of doubling Tyreek Hill. He's still going to hit some on you. We saw that yesterday. Right. He hit one or two. And then man covering, Kelce. And I think the Seahawk philosophy was, let's try to sort of dare Andrew Reid to run the ball. Typically he won't take full advantage of that. And so I thought when they put Stephon Gilmore on Kelce, that was a logical move to make. We've seen that, you know, in other situations. It seems like Seattle did that to Vernon Davis in the playoffs years ago. You know, put a Sherman or some corner, or maybe it was Browner on him or something, that sort of thing. So I like that. It was great use of a big free agent addition for them. And then the thing that you don't think about for your defense is they just didn't let the Chiefs offense be on the field. So I think no matter what Bill Belichick's plan was, part of it was fewer drives, fewer possessions. Don't let them, because you give them four more possessions, and we're asking today, we're like, is Gronk retiring now? Because they were a lot of games. So the offense was a huge part of the defense.
Yeah, of course. I mean, the Patriots had, 94 plays, I believe, to 43 or 46 from the Chiefs. Very reminiscent of the Patriots-Falcons game from the Super Bowl a couple years ago, where by the end of the game, you know, the Chiefs didn't have the ball, and the Patriots were playing a gas defense and were able to move the ball when they needed to. Again, Chiefs, you know, could have come up with a third down stop. That would have changed the game in overtime. But, they weren't able to. That was just the simple reality of it. And Damian Williams did have three touchdowns, two as a receiver, one as a rusher. Sammy Watkins did get to 114 yards, had a couple big plays on the pick play I mentioned, and then the sort of scramble play past Gilmore for a big gain. But, I mean, overall, this is how Belichick would have drawn it up. I think he would have hoped that they don't throw an interception in the end zone. I think he would have hoped that they don't throw a second pick off of Edelman's fingertips. They were sloppy for stretches of this game. I think it's certainly fair to say the Chiefs, of course, Mahomes did miss a would-be touchdown pass to Damian Williams. That would have made it three touchdowns for him as a receiver and on a drive where they ended up punting because of a really bad sack two plays later. In terms of the Chiefs, we'll finish up here and we'll get to Rams Saints after the break. Do you think this was their best chance at winning a Super Bowl for the foreseeable future?
No. I mean, it's their best chance this year. I mean, you don't know what it's going to be in the future, but I really just think that they'll get better because next year, I would think, they'll probably add a couple pieces to help their defense. You know, I think they made some strides there late in the year by playing some younger guys. And Mahomes will have a year of seasoning. I mean, we forget that he's – we don't forget. But, I mean, he's got all the talent in the world, but now he's seen it. You know, the league's seen him too, but I think he'll continue to grow into his role and improve. And I don't feel – I mean, every opportunity is precious, but I feel differently for this than I did. Like, remember when the 49ers had the home playoff game 5 years ago or 7 years ago and they lost to the Giants? That might have been the Kyle Williams fumble game. Remember that?
Yeah, for sure.
I felt at the time that, oh, man, 49ers, that was your chance. And they did end up getting to a Super Bowl, but those opportunities are precious, and I just felt like that was really squandered. I feel like the Chiefs so exceeded even optimistic expectations for what their offense was going to do in the first year of a new starter, even if you love Mahomes, that I just can't wait to see him next year, and I'd take my chances with him. You know, I think they're going to be right there and be back in the AFC Championship game again.
Yeah, not out of the question. The thing I worry about is just you have a lot of guys right now who are cheap, who are not going to be cheap in the near future. Mahomes, of course, on a rookie deal. Tyreek Hill on a rookie deal. On the defensive side of the ball, Chris Jones is on a rookie deal. Those guys are all going to get paid pretty soon. Not that you're not going to pay them. I think they obviously deserve to get big deals. Kelsey is going to get a new contract as well, probably in the next couple of years. And you have guys that you might move on from, but Eric Berry, you know, you're not going to be able to keep Eric Berry making $20 million a year. They're probably going to cut Justin Houston at the end of the year. They're going to have to give Dee Ford, who is on a fifth-year option, a raise as part of an extension, or he's going to be on the franchise tag for a pretty big raise. I mean, they're a team that I think they have a very cheap young core of all pro level talent that is not going to be cheap in the next couple of years. And the example I might think about when it comes to Mahomes, I don't think this is likely to be the case. I'm just saying this is a scenario that has played out in the past. Is the most, if I asked you, like, who was the most obvious comparison to Mahomes in terms of breaking out in his second season in NFL history, who would you say it was?
Second season, Marino, maybe?
Marino was the exact person I was thinking of. And Dan Marino made it to the Super Bowl in that second season. And with the Dolphins, you would have figured, okay, we got a Hall of Fame legendary coach. We have a young quarterback who just won the MVP in the second year, a season that nobody could have expected. Even given that he was a first-round pick, you'd figure, okay, well, we're going to be set. We're going to make a bunch of Super Bowl runs over the next decade. They never got back to the Super Bowl. They made back to the conference championship twice, and they lost both times. And they were good for a long time. But even though you would have figured they were going to be set to make Super Bowl after Super Bowl, they didn't get back. They just knew, the pieces never came together again in the same way. So I'm not saying that's going to happen with the Chiefs. I don't think it's fair to say that, but that is at least within the range of possibilities, Patrick Mahomes is going to be great.
It's so true, Bill. And so I was talking to a coach who was on his way to Mobile today, and we were just marveling at, you know, the Saints have had Drew Brees and Sean Payton together for over a decade. They got one Super Bowl.
Yeah,
McCarthy and Rodgers together for over a decade. They win one Super Bowl. McCarthy's fired. You can on and on you go. These are hard to win. So I think your point is a really good one that our optimism doesn't guarantee results. I think they're going to have several swings at it. And,
for sure.
You know, I think that Eric Berry is. They don't need Eric Berry at this point. It's not like he's, you know, on the top of his game. There's other places they may be able to go. I mean, they'll have to make a decision Tyreek Hill, and I know they paid Sammy Watkins, so that's interesting. But I think their window is going to be open enough, and then, you know, you would think eventually that, you know, I mean, maybe Brady still will be doing this in 3 years, but, you know, I just don't see Mahomes being any easier to defend for the next few years. So I like their chances, but your point's really well taken.
Well, I think if I got a well-taken point from Mike Sando, I'm going to take that to break before I ruin it with any subsequent points. We're going to come back with more Bill Barnwell here talking about the Saints-Rams game in a moment. All right, back here on the Bill Barnwell Show with Mike Sando of ESPN. We're going to recap the Saints-Rams game, and we already got to a little bit of that pass interference call during the first segment. Obviously, it's the biggest story coming out of this game. It would have obviously put the Saints in a very advantageous space. They could have kicked a field goal to win the game with about 20 seconds left. So it would have, unless something horrible happened, would have won them the game. The only thing I would say about the call and the coverage afterwards is this. Yes, it would have won them the game, but it's not as if they lost the game by virtue of not getting that pass interference call. They could have, for example, run the ball 3 times on that drive and not thrown the ball and been able to kick a field goal with 40 seconds or so left on the clock, or I think 50 seconds left on the clock, for the Rams to try and tie the game up with no timeouts. They could have stopped the Rams on the subsequent drive to prevent them from kicking a field goal to send it overtime. They could have not thrown an interception when they won the coin toss on the first drive of overtime. And this was a Saints team that, yes, that call was absolutely horrific, and I think they would have won the game were it not for that call. But that call did not cost them the game in itself. They could have come up with a stop on either of those drives and scored themselves, and they were not able to. I understand the pain there, certainly, but it's more than just that one call.
Absolutely, and I think the call is overshadowing, you know, either the Sean Payton decision to throw that pass that was incomplete with, I don't know, they're right around 2 minutes or under 2 minutes, but why can't Michael Thomas and Drew Brees connect on a 5-yard pass?
Right.
I mean, you know, in defense of Payton, he's thinking that's a 90% play. He's going to trust them on that play, and we can criticize him for throwing it, but that was a huge play. Further, the bigger autopsy on the Saints is they played 18 games this year. If you divide those games into the first 11 versus the last 7, and the last 7 starts with that Dallas game. Mm-hmm. They go from 36 points a game to 19.
Yeah.
They go from 86 QBR to 50, which 50 is average. I mean, that's like a bad year for Andy Dalton. Okay, they go from 0.4 expected points added per pass attempt to 0.02.
Wow.
0.4 to 0.02. They go, everything just goes south. They go from 8 touchdown drives with 4 plays or fewer to 1. Everything you look at is down, the rushing, the passing. I mean, we can talk about Ted Ginn all we want, but that's not it. That's not all of it. I mean,
right.
What's going on? Because they should have been at home. They should have been up big in that game the way it went early. They're kicking field goals early. I mean, that's where this game that exposed the Saints for what they were the last 7 games, and I don't have a great answer for what happened.
Yeah, I mean, you assume it's a little bit of everything, right? The offensive line wasn't as healthy. Yeah. You had Terron Armstead, who was injured, and Andres Pete clearly had a broken hand, wasn't 100% in the postseason. But I think some of it falls on Brees. I mean, Brees clearly was not 100%. It seemed like to me, we had, I believe it was Ted Wynn talking about it on the show earlier last week, about the fact that Brees was not 100% in his throws and didn't seem to be healthy, on some of his deeper passes. And we, you know, realistically, Brees was not great in this game. The interception, I don't really blame him for. I mean, he was hit in his motion, but some decisions that were questionable, even the long pass to Ginn that set up the, you know, the red zone possession where there was the pass interference penalty, he didn't seem confident about making the throw. I mean, he sort of, you know, triple loaded up the holster before he was willing to take the shot, which is not his
yes.
style. That's not his personality. And the pass wasn't great. It was sort of hung up in the air for a while. Honestly, LaMarcus Joyner should have picked it off, or should have been able to knock it away at the very least, but went for the interception and kind of got caught between two worlds and wasn't able to pick it off, and Ginn made a nice catch. But I mean, it doesn't, you know, he was the MVP for me until that Cowboys game. And from that point forward, he was not the same guy, like you said.
Yep, and so speaking of could he throw the ball down the field, so those first 11 games, he had 24 completions with 20 or greater air yards. He had seven after that. He had 11 touchdown passes gaining more than 15 yards down to one.
Wow.
All of those big explosive play measures, you know, they had 10 touchdowns from outside the red zone, over 20 yards, down to one in the final seven games. So clearly something going on there. Maybe we'll find out, hey, Drew Brees underwent surgery for his labrum or whatever, you know, something that, you know, he was playing through and never caused him to miss a practice, so he didn't have to put it on the report or whatever. But clearly something was up that I think if it wasn't up, I think they'd be in the Super Bowl, and I'd love their chances.
Yeah, I would too. I thought they, you know, as you mentioned, on those two early drives where they're dominating an offense, They only get a field goal because Dan Arnold, I believe, was the one who dropped the seam route, which again, Brees threw into double coverage. There was a deep safety there as opposed to taking one of his outside routes one-on-one. They kick a field goal. The dome is rocking. They get an interception from Goff. They don't score a touchdown again. They end up kicking, throw a screen on third and seven or eight, I believe, and then kick a field goal on fourth and four instead of, you know, I would have understood going for it. I don't think it would be. Most coaches wouldn't do it, but I'd understand that situation going for it. But you only get two field goals when you're dominating in the first quarter to go up 6-0. Reminded me a lot of the Packers Seahawks game from a few years ago, where the decisions weren't as obviously a situation to go for it. I don't fault Payton necessarily for kicking field goals in situations, whereas McCarthy, I think they were both fourth and goal from the 1 yard line or the 2 yard line, where he decided to kick field goals with Aaron Rodgers as his quarterback. You know, obviously
at least
those
was against
decisions.
A great Seattle D,
yes.
Right?
I mean, for sure.
You know, the Ram D, you know, has had his moments, but it's not that type of defense. So,
of course not.
Yeah.
And that was on the road as well, as opposed to being at home. But it's a situation where, you know, a team dominated for a long time, and you figure, well, they're in great shape to win the game. And then when they lost by the end, you look back and said, okay, well, wow, like, you know, they only got 6 points out of this quarter where they were, you know, absolutely the better football team and it wasn't particularly close.
Yep. And the Rams were loving that. This was an avalanche that got no snow, you know, no snow on their glasses. They didn't have to pick up their glasses and wipe them off. It was like this avalanche that didn't hurt. They could breathe and they were able to play the game. So totally, totally let them off the hook, you know, to quote Dennis Green.
Yeah, and Saints did score, to be fair, to go up 13-0 with a minute left, and a minute 40 left in the quarter to go up 13-0, but you get the point. I mean, this was a situation where the Saints dominated that quarter and, you know, should have been up 20-0 and were not by the end of the quarter. I will ask you, and I don't know, I was actually going to tweet about it. No one's going to believe me. I was tweeting about it as it happened, did not get the tweet out in time, but shouldn't, if anyone's going to suspect a fake punt on fourth and five on the 30-yard line in the playoffs, shouldn't it be the Saints who did this exact same thing on fourth and one in the second quarter when their offense was not working last week, playing the Rams, who have Johnny Hecker, who will fake punt in just about any situation if it's there? It shocked me that they were not more suspecting of the fake punt that worked out for the Rams.
Every time the Rams go to punt, I'm like, okay, When Fisher was there, they threw from their own end zone once. You know, it was just one of those where it was like at the discretion of the kicker and so or the punter. So, yes, that would have been a good tweet. Best tweets that never got tweeted.
Yeah, it's a shame. But, I mean, like, it just – I don't think that – there are some times where you'll have a fake punt or a fourth down decision, and it'll be easy to look in hindsight and say, oh, well, they should have saw that coming. And sometimes that's true. Sometimes that's skeptical. This was a situation where even if you can't say, okay, fake punt is going to happen – I would be very cautious about at least, you know, having my gunners or having my defensive backs out there saying, okay, we need to pay attention to this because they are the most fake happy team in the league and they are in an absolutely desperate situation. It is the beginning of the second quarter. They have not produced a single first down on offense so far in this game. Yep. Look out for this. Yep. And it ended up turning the game. I mean, it didn't win the Rams the game on its own, but they continue on that drive. They finally get some traction on offense. They kick a field goal. To go up, to get within 10 points at 13-3. I mean, I don't know if the Saints win that game if that fake punt is incomplete or if they don't get to attempt a fake punt, but I mean, stranger things have happened, and this was a game that every point mattered in the very end. So I think that really hurt the Saints' chances and kind of surprised me that they weren't looking out for it.
We should profile fake punts and find the sweet spot when they're done. It's like, hey, you're on the road, mm-hmm. you know, you're down, and you're down, but not all the way out of it, but it could slip away. It's sort of like you're looking for a jump stop. We could probably, I would love to stack all the fake punts and just say, ah, yep, it's the second quarter when you're down by more than one score and you've got fewer than four first downs, and this is when it happens, right? And then we can all sort of intuitively feel when it should happen.
Right, of course. And you would hope that the Saints would have just an intuitive feel for that just based on their own usage of fake punts, yep. but did not try
to. I think
to
they were really good in special teams. Were they? I think their special teams was good this year, too, in terms what? Of I think they may have been number one in our expected points metric just for all special teams plays.
Mm-hmm. Right. No, I think they were very good in special teams in general, but that was just a bad mess. I will say, though, yep. I don't think that was the worst coaching decision of this game. I'm not sure if you agree with me, but when the Rams kicked a field goal to make it 20-20 with 5 minutes left, and Drew Brees, even though he's not, you know, capital D, capital B, Drew Brees on the other side of the field, at, you know, on the road in a game where you have fourth and an inch, maybe, and you spent all of last week, you know, going in the media talking about how you were a physical run first football team. I was shocked the Rams won this game. I was 100% sure they were going to lose because, the football gods, I suppose, would punish Sean McVay for being such a conservative decision maker in such a key moment. I cannot believe they kicked a field goal in that situation.
I know it because against Dallas, they were really rallying around the fact that they had put it on the offensive line's backs, and I was at that game, and I was studying the sideline after the play. I mean, those guys were walking around like pro wrestlers, you know, getting themselves fired up before a match or something. Just mm-hmm. It would almost look like, could they really be this excited? They were. They were just completely psyched because they put it on them. They ran it in a fourth down situation. So mm-hmm. I agree. Everything says go for it there. And I didn't hear, did McVay, is there a good explanation? Did McVay have one? I mean,
no.
He won the game, it didn't hurt him. But
he gave the same just generic quote about how, you know, he felt like the offense was moving the ball well and felt like if the defense was playing well. Let me get the exact quote here. With the fourth down deal, McVay said, we were moving the ball really well. Sure. I think our defense had played really good football up to that point, so I figured, okay, if we get it to a tie game, we feel good about the outcome, being able to turn in our favor if we were able to get a couple of possessions. Ultimately, it ended up working out because of our players. That's not why I would say it worked out. It worked out because the referees gifted the Rams a miraculous non-call on a pass interference penalty, and we'd be talking about this call very differently had it worked out the way that it perhaps should have. But I just, you know, that's not the way to think about this. If your offense is moving the ball really well, you should trust it to get an inch. Like, you shouldn't have to worry about your offense not getting an inch. You should trust that you can leap over the pile with your first overall pick at quarterback. You should hand the ball to your suddenly ferocious short yardage back and hope that your offensive line that you've spent all week bragging about can get an inch. And Sean McVay did not trust his offense to do that.
Yes, and you know, I think there's a distinction between being a great young play caller designer and mm-hmm. being a great decision maker or yeah. game manager, all those types of things, you know. And you know, we watch the games and see Sean McVay on the Gatorade cooler, you know, going over the offense when the defense is going and stuff. So mm-hmm. If you were to say what are the great things he brings to the team, maybe we don't know yet on the management of the games, making the right decisions. They've been so good offensively that they've been able to just win the games, and we haven't been talking about, you know, that element of it as much. But yesterday, definitely, there were a couple that, you know, we put on the list.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's a huge opportunity for the Patriots to exploit in the game where you have McVay, who's inexperienced, still managing games on one side of the field in the Super Bowl, and on the other side, you have Bill Belichick, who, well, he's about as good as anybody when it comes to managing fourth down situations and managing the clock and timeouts and that game situation. Seems like that's going to be a huge sort of opportunity for the Patriots to gain an advantage in what might be an otherwise close Super Bowl.
Yeah, absolutely. The whole planning, I think they're going to have a great plan. I think the running can work on the Rams too. You know, and I know they've been better against the run. Certainly they were great against Dallas, but you know, I went to a few of their games this year, and I think Seattle might have had 500 and some yards rushing against them. So I would expect that to be part of the plan for the Patriots, to be balanced and you know, take their chances a little bit against a Rams defense offense that is really good, but is diminished. I mean, without Cooper Kupp, Gurley can say he's not healthy, but he's not the same. You know, and during the game, I was at the Dallas games riding the bike some of the time between series and stuff. There's something wrong with them, so. They're a little bit less dynamic, I think, than they've been earlier in the year, you know, and that makes this a game different than playing them early in the year or even playing the Chiefs for New England.
Yeah, I mean, I think the Gurley thing's really fascinating. Obviously, only 5 touches in this game, you know, missed long stretches of time, dropped a pass that turned into an interception, missed a pass block on Eli Apple that nearly forced a mistake from the Rams. He says he's healthy, just says he was playing poorly. You know, this is an offense that used Todd Gurley 90%+ of the time when he was healthy. They did not rotate their backs. They didn't want to keep him fresh. They didn't go with the flow of the game. They didn't take Todd Gurley out for Malcolm Brown when Malcolm Brown was, you know, had a good run or two. They didn't do that. So, I'm skeptical that there's not something wrong here. And I think from the Patriots perspective, it's really fascinating to think about when you think about your Super Bowl game plan, because typically in a vacuum, if I'd asked you this question in week 10, said, hey, well, how's Belichick going to plan to stop the Rams? You'd figure, okay, well, it's going to be the Marshall Faulk, you know, Super Bowl 2001 game plan of let's hit him on every play. Let's take him out of the game. Let's force Jared Goff to throw the ball to his receivers. Now, I don't know if you plan things that way, because Todd Gurley doesn't appear to be the same guy.
Yep. No, I agree. And, you know, there's been an ongoing conversation among, you know, people covering the league this year of, you know, what's the value of the run game? What's the value of a back? But you know, one of the universal things you hear talking to people in the league is, man, without Gurley, they would really, really be diminished, you know, more than most teams would be by losing their back. That people feel like he's added a special element to their offense beyond what you would get from a replacement. I know C.J. Anderson's come in and done a great job, but he probably wouldn't do that great job for 60 straight games. Literally does. So there's definitely something missed there. Remember, they're 90% 11 personnel, yep. You know, one back, three receiver offense. They don't change up the personnel a lot. And, you know, maybe we're seeing some limits of that as far as what he can do. And he's had injury history, you know, in the past. So it's a little bit worrisome.
Yeah, I think so for sure. The Rams did actually.
They paid him a ton.
They already paid him a ton. Yeah. And I think, I don't think they would go back and not pay him now. But at least you're having second thoughts where it's, okay, well, what if we, you know, not just having C.J. Anderson, but what if we had a rookie and C.J. Anderson and maybe another guy off the street who's making $2 million, or maybe we signed Jerick McKinnon if the Niners cut him this year, and we have, you know, three backs we have faith in, and it's not just Gurley, and we use that, you know, $10 million a year we'd have left over on a linebacker or someone to help out, you know, an extra pass rusher on the edge. Who knows? I'm not saying that it's, you know, I don't think we've seen enough from the Rams offense to say that Todd Gurley's a waste of money. I don't think that's fair to say, but at least that conversation about, oh, well, they're going to really struggle without Gurley. We've seen C.J. Anderson step in and be effective in, you know, in a small sample, like you said, but in a small sample, still some semblance of a sample. And they did actually change their personnel in this game more than you would figure. They, like you said, 11 personnel, more than, I think it was 92% of the time during the regular season, at least 91% in the regular season. And in this game, about 30% of the time, they went with 2 tight ends, went with 12 personnel, and they were more effective by success rate. They had, I think, a 75 or 74% success rate in that 12 personnel versus something in the 40s, the 45, 46% range in 11 personnel. So I think it'll be fascinating for the Patriots' perspective, again, to think about, you know, as the Rams game plan in this game, do you come out with more 12 personnel in the Super Bowl and sort of dare the Patriots to, you know, have to stop the run? Or do you think they go back to 11 personnel as their base and sort of, you know, go with what brought them to the dance?
Well, 12 makes more sense now if you don't have the 3 great receivers, right?
Right.
you're a little bit diminished at receiver. And you're also a little bit diminished at running back. So the tight end, the second tight end gives you, you know, a player who's a little bit more like a running back than a wide receiver is. those are a couple things. You know, on I wanted to follow up on your points about Gurley and paying him. I felt like there were three factors. I felt like, number one, McVay really liked him for his offense. Number two, Aaron Donald was unsigned, and they really wanted to show the team they were going to take care of the guys, and that was sort of a little bit ugly. Mm-hmm. And then they also wanted to pay for his prime years instead of doing an extension 2 years from now and getting 3 years they don't want. Right. So that was their thinking, but now as they're going into this game, it's not a long-term thought process. It's a one-game thought process. Mm-hmm. He's not right. Does the 2 weeks allow him to get right enough? I thought he was pretty good against Dallas, didn't you? Mm-hmm. I mean, he was certainly a good starting running back in the game. He wasn't bad. I mean, he had over 100 yards.
Yes. I mean, like, it wasn't, you know, I felt like Anderson was playing really well, and so I wasn't surprised. And once they're up, you figure, okay, well, if Gurley's not 100%, you know, put Anderson in there, let him sort of absorb the workload, keep Gurley fresh for the next round. You might have a closer game, but I mean, things changed. And in this game, you know, he did struggle. He looked like he was not the same guy, and it was, you know, they kept him on the field. They didn't bench him, in the middle of a drive, but the fact that he sat out the entire third quarter was pretty staggering. I don't think we're going to know how he really is until we get to the Super Bowl.
Yep, that's a real problem for them. It's such a big part of what they did, and it's a nice story that C.J. Anderson's filled in, but, you know, people would rather face C.J. Anderson.
Right, of course. And I think it's going to be a really fascinating matchup to think about how the Rams approach it, how the Patriots approach it, how the Rams, you know, what they show, what they don't show, and how the Patriots, you know, plan for an offense that could be something close to what we saw during the regular season with Gurley and 11 personnel, or could be something totally different with CJ Anderson and 12 personnel. It's going to be a lot of mystery in the weeks to come. But in terms of the Saints, Ash, the same question about the Chiefs. Was this their best chance of winning a Super Bowl in the final years of the Drew Brees era?
I think so. I mean, they had the home field advantage. The Rams had fallen off some late in the year, were a good team, but not hitting on all cylinders. If the Saints could have been the hitting on all cylinders team, go and punch their ticket, and they're in great shape. They even get to win it in Atlanta. I would have probably favored them, but they'll still probably be a good team next year. But you know, does Drew Brees decline at the end of the year? Do you have a bad luck injury, you know, with one of your other key players? Do some of those offensive linemen who are banged up this year, you know, are they banged up again? I think all those things clouded for them.
Yeah, I think there's a little bit at least of, well, this is going to be an interesting way to put it, 2014, where Peyton Manning did decline in the final 3 weeks of the year. During that, the Chargers game was the big one where he looked like he wasn't 100%, and then they lost to the Colts. They fired John Fox. And the next year, Peyton Manning had fallen off the cliff. He was not the same guy. Now, granted, they won a Super Bowl, so I don't know if that's the comparison to think about, like, it's not the worst thing in the world for the Saints, but they had, can the Saints defense, and I'm not saying they can't, I'm asking you the question, can they be as good as that Broncos defense if Drew Brees is not the same? If he's the guy we saw during the second half of this season over the final seven games, if he's that guy in 2019, can the Saints win a Super Bowl with the rest of their roster as currently constructed?
To me, no way. I mean, that Denver defense was special. It was number one by a margin, and the Saints defense is, you know, statistically, you know, anywhere from probably 10 to 25, depending how you measure it. It's just not a great defense. So I also think the NFC South, I could easily see one of those other teams coming back, you know, and winning 10, 11 games this year. Carolina could, if they get some things fixed on defense and Newton's healthy. Atlanta has a good roster if they're healthier. So, you know, I think it gets tough for them. Green Bay could be better, you know. Seattle now looks like a decent team. The Rams are going to be good again. Yeah. If the 49ers get Garoppolo going, you see where I'm going with this? The Eagles get Wentz back, and they're a good team again. I mean, it's just, does Bruce Arians put life into Jameis? I mean, there's just a lot of things that can happen in the NFC.
I'm excited for 2019 now. Now I'm all excited about how 2019 is going to break down. We still have one more game to go. We have the Super Bowl coming up, and next week we're going to preview, I think we're going to do at least one podcast, probably two, like we did last year, previewing the big game, Patriots-Rams. But until then, Mike, where can people check out more of your stuff at ESPN?
Yeah, certainly. You can follow me on Twitter, SandoESPN, and then in the E-plus section there of your local ESPN app.
The local app. I'd highly recommend it. Check out Mike's work. It's phenomenal. If you want to learn more about the game of football, what people are thinking around the league, I would absolutely recommend subscribing to E-plus and checking out Mike's stuff. Mike, it's always an easy show when you're on. It's always a pleasure. Thank you so much for hopping on today.
Thank you.
All right, so thanks so much for listening today, guys, and more audio coming next week.